Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals and exploring the complexity of their lives, their intelligence, relationships, families, social connections, and emotions. I also love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Welcome to another episode of Wild Connection, where we explore the frontiers of science, its impact on our lives, and how it connects us to each other and other species. On this episode, I talk to Dr. Ben Stanger, a distinguished author and expert in cellular biology. He's also a physician. Dr. Stanger's latest book, From One Cell, A Journey into Life's Origin and the Future of Medicine, explains the mysteries of cellular development and its profound implications for understanding life itself. In his book, Dr. Stanger masterfully navigates through the intricate landscape of cellular biology, tracing the historical milestones that have shaped our current understanding. This includes groundbreaking discoveries of cell division to the more contemporary insights into cellular differentiation. And yes, we're talking stem cells. Through it all, Dr. Stanger illuminates the complexity of life at its most fundamental level. But his book is more than just recounting scientific achievements. It's a testament to the ongoing quest to unravel the mysteries of development. And this has implications for us today. He eloquently demonstrates how comprehending this complexity is not just an academic pursuit and a creative pursuit, but it's a vital step towards conquering diseases that impact so many people that we may know, including type 1 diabetes and cancer. Now, we recorded this last summer before the book was to be released in August, but I was in the field in Uganda, and that delayed me releasing this episode. But given the latest out of Alabama and the ruling from the Alabama Supreme Court, I actually think the timing is perfect. So for everyone out there listening, please share this with those justices who seem to have forgotten what they learned in biology class. Now, before we get started, if you enjoy this episode with Dr. Stanger, please take a moment to like, share, and rate our podcast on your favorite platform. Your support helps us reach more listeners and continue bringing you fascinating content. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Wild Connect Pod for updates and behind-the-scenes insights. We value your feedback, so let us know what topics you'd like to hear more about in future episodes. And be sure to check out the show notes on our website for additional resources and references from today's discussion. You can find that on my personal website, www.jennifervertelin.com, or Wild Connection, the podcast hosted by Podbean. Okay, here we go, where science meets inspiration. Hey, everybody, welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm really excited today to welcome author and biologist and physician, Dr. Ben Stanger. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jennifer. It's great to be here.
You know, I really love your new book, From One Cell, A Journey into Life's Origins and the Future of Medicine. But before we get into the details of the book, you know, we share a kinship with many other species in the sense that we all, however we got here, we all started as a single cell and embryo. And I'm curious, how did you become interested in cellular and developmental biology?
Wow, it's been a winding path. Thanks so much for having me here. So I grew up in New York City, and it's not the first place you think of when you think of, you know, the animal world and nature. But one thing that New York has is a lot of educational opportunities for anyone. So as I was growing up there, I went to the New York Academy of Sciences, the Natural History Museum, got really into nature, but from a more molecular standpoint. And so I was interested in questions of how did life begin from chemicals and molecules and that sort of thing. So I went to medical school, I got a PhD along the way, and found myself really fascinated in questions of developmental biology. What is, you know, from the chemistry of life to the chemistry of embryonic development and animals and so forth. And so I did work in embryonic development during my postdoctoral fellowship, and now I run a research laboratory that's cancer-based.
Okay, wow. You know, I'm always fascinated with how people kind of arrive where they are, and you wear many hats, right? You have a PhD and an MD, and you know, I sort of like to call it Evo Devo, you know, evolution and developmental biology or developmental biology, and you're also a cancer biologist. And you've seen that a lot of things can kind of go sideways when it comes to development. And in From One Cell, you take readers on a journey with the history, the anticipation, the perplexity, and the thrill of new discoveries that begin in a single cell that leads to what is hopefully a fully functioning new individual. You know, what motivated you to write this book and tackle such a large and complicated topic?
So as I mentioned, my postdoctoral work after my PhD was in development, how organs are shaped and how they achieve the right size, which is a big question in developmental biology. But the work that I did, my the laboratory I did my work in was a stem cell laboratory. And stem cells were really big in the news back then. And I thought, okay, this is a subject I know pretty well. It's a subject that's captured the imagination of a lot of people. Maybe I can write sort of an insider's guide to stem cells. So I started on that path thinking, you know, maybe an article or a series of articles. And as I was doing my research and thinking about it, I realized what really interests me is embryology. And stem cells are just a part of that. And for that, talking to a few people, it sort of became clear that this needed to be a book. And there wasn't one like it already. So that's where the book came from.
Oh, that's great. And it's not a small undertaking to try to translate all of this complexity of developmental biology into an accessible book. And you do that really, really well. And so I would want you know, the audience to realize you can grasp this. It's not your same intro biology class that you took that terrified you in college. It's really so well written. And one of the things that I think many people wouldn't realize is that for centuries we've been on the hunt for solving a mystery. And this is kind of what science is all about, too, is we're detectives. What is the single cell problem and why was it a problem?
Well, it's a problem because nature had to figure out a couple of things when life went from unicellular organisms to multicellular organisms. Unicellular organisms need to do a lot. They need to eat, they need to generate energy, they need to move a little bit, and they need to divide. So those are all things that we're kind of familiar with as being part of life. But what is so amazing about multicellularity, the animal world, is that there are these many, many different kinds of cells, and they each have different jobs that allow an animal to do things that a bacterial cell couldn't possibly do. And not only does nature have to generate these many different types of cells from one cell, but they all have to work together and they all have to get to the right place and they have to be able to change and adapt to all the crazy things that happen as we go about our lives. And so the one cell problem, if you will, is how do you go from one cell to not only many cells, but many different kinds of cells that all do their job appropriately.
And we're going to talk more about how cells divide up into different jobs and how they communicate with one another. But first, you know, what I really enjoyed in the beginning was you asked your six-year-old where babies came from, and she gave you the same answer that many, many, you know, people believed for a long time, despite, you know, some great thinkers like Aristotle proposing something a bit more accurate. And this was pre-formationism. So, or I guess, I don't know if it would be right to say, you know, fully formed miniatures of human beings. And so why do so many people maybe still succumb to the idea that, is it a blastocyte?
A blastocyst or
a, okay, a blastocyst, which, you know, maybe we can define that too, is really just a miniature, either miniature giraffe or a miniature person, especially given our scientific advancements.
Well, because I think we're just completely unfamiliar with that world of the early embryo. I think, you know, when you think of an embryo, most people are probably thinking of a fetus, of something that looks like a creature, whether it's a animal or a human being. It has many of those organs and those features already recognizable. But what happens very early, if you just think about it for a second, is we start off with one cell, and then you have two, and then you have four, and so on and so on. It looks like nothing except a cluster of little cells, but that is the embryo, and that is how we all started. We didn't even realize, that life was made up of cells until the 19th century with cell theory. So before that, this idea that you mentioned of preformationism was really the leading idea. Well, of course, you know, if you don't have cells to understand how we come about, then of course you think, well, we started off as just mini-me's inside the womb, and just kind of expanded from that. So that was the prevailing view for centuries. It you know, got even more interesting than that, because certain people who really held on to this view sort of rationalized it a step further. Like, if you are a mini-me inside a fertilized egg, well, inside that mini-me, if it was a female, there would be an ovary, and that ovary would have eggs, and those eggs would have mini-me's in them as well. So those thinkers sort of imagined an almost infinite succession of miniature versions of future animals, people, whatever.
So that's like a Russian doll, right? Like, basically.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Right.
Well, and I think it was really useful, and thank you for helping to distinguish between, you know, a single cell and an embryo, and then also a fetus. I think that's really helpful when we're trying to orient to some of the things that we're going to talk about. And one of the things I wanted to talk about is, aside from just how overall you eloquently describe experiments of different scientists who have advanced our knowledge in these areas, you describe the contrasting work of two early scientists to explain how there's a difference in cell interpretation of development in what we know from a frog versus a sea urchin, those two species that were particularly involved. And it made me wonder, is there any flexibility in what a particular cell will become at the stage of a single cell?
That is a great question. And it goes to something that I think we all think about all the time, whether it's biology or behavior or what have you, which is nature versus nurture. So you're basically asking a nature versus nurture question. As you go from that one cell to two to four, et cetera, are each of those cells programmed to follow a particular path, and that's what they're going to do no matter what? Or can they change their direction as events are changing on the ground? And, you know, as we know from most things in life, the answer is yes, both of those things happen. And these early experimentalists way back in the 19th century were grappling with that principle. Some thought one individual in particular did an experiment and concluded everything is fixed. And once that cell divides into two, one of those two cells is going to give rise to half the animal, the right half, let's say, and the other cell is going to give rise to the left half of the animal. And then another researcher came along, Hans Driesch, and he actually showed, no, you can actually get the cell, each of those cells, to change its path if you perturb it in some way. And that's called regulation or regulative behavior of embryonic cells. So both things happen during development. There are certain fates, we call them, that are fixed, and there are some fates that can change depending on what's happening.
Yeah, and sometimes it depends on the severity of the disturbance you undergo at different phases, and we can all relate to that even as fully grown beings. How we respond to our environment, you know, might depend on the strength of the input that's coming in from the environment or the type. But going back to fertilized eggs or zygotes, right? Are they zygotes?
Yep.
Okay, so I'm just, you know, making sure my terminology is right. So we've got this fertilized eggs, a sperm met an egg and they, you know, had a party and they made a zygote. And then we have that first single cell, right? And then after that, there's all these divisions that then create the embryo and later the fetus. But, you know, how during those divisions does the cell, I guess the single cell, know where to put everything, like the body plan? Like, how do you know where your arms go and your legs go and your brain goes and your kidneys go and your eyes go, if you have eyes, you know, like, yeah. how do you know where to put everything?
Well, so it really depends on the species. In some species, that first cell is actually already a little bit organized. So for example, where the sperm hits in the cell determines which part of that cell, when it divides, is going to give to rise to what part of the organism. In other species, it's quite different. In other species, there isn't really much determination until you get to more than 4 or 8 cells. And by that time, actually a little bit later, maybe once you're an embryo of around 16 cells, now there are some spatial differences, and the cells can tell, for example, in this cluster of 16 cells, some are on the inside. And so at every edge that they look at, all they see is other cells. But then there are other cells that are on the outside, and so they can see cells on one side of their membrane and nothing on the other side. And that difference between inner cells and outer cells may be enough to give instructions to those cells for what part of the embryo to become. So it's very complicated. There's lots and lots of communication between these cells as they're dividing. But it really depends from one animal to the next, whether that information of what to become happens very early at the single cell stage or a little bit later.
Okay. And we're going to talk in a little bit about, you know, I mean, in all relationships, whether they're cellular or human or other animal, communication is probably pretty important. And so we'll circle back to communication and miscommunication in a little bit. But I remember learning and attempting to teach. I'm not a geneticist and I'm not a developmental biologist, but I have taught, you know, that second half of biology that involves the cellular part or the molecular part. And there's this like little box of genes that turn on at certain points and basically have the blueprint for a giraffe, let's say, where the legs go. And so I think those are called homeobox genes. And they, what do they do? And do they ever get it wrong?
Great question. So, right. So inside every cell, there's a nucleus, and that nucleus holds the genome, the entire copy of DNA for the organism. And one of the important discoveries that wasn't even really firmly established until the 1960s is that every cell in the body has the same DNA. So this is, again, was a concept that many people thought, well, how do you get all these different kinds of cells in the body Well, it must be that different cells have different DNA, because the DNA is the instruction. So as you're making the body, you get rid of, you know, if you're going to become the liver, you get rid of all the genes that don't have anything to do with the liver. And so you're left with the liver genome. But it's not that way. The case is that every cell has a complete set of DNA. And so the way that you determine these different tissues is by determining which genes are on and which genes are off. What you're asking about is how do we organize the body plan, the overall organization from head to toe of an animal? How do you know what should go in front of what and behind what and so on and so forth? So that is all, everything about development is encoded somewhere in the genome. And there are a special collection of genes that evolved very, very long ago, early in multicellularity, called homeobox genes, which dictate which part of the body should go first, second, third, and fourth, depending on which ones are on. So if you have Hox gene A2 and B2 and C2, then that tells you you're going to be part of the head. And if you have another combination of Hox genes, that tells you that you're going to be part of the torso, and so on and so forth. Usually animals get it right. Usually the embryo gets it right. But if there's some error in a Hox gene, or a Hox gene gets turned on in some cells that it wouldn't normally get turned on in, then you can get all kinds of weird, misshapen things happening. You can see, this is most commonly studied in the fly, but you can see flies, you can find flies where there are legs growing out from where the antenna should be, where there's a second set of wings growing out from a different part of the body. So all of this is controlled very carefully and regulated appropriately most of the time, but you can really see how nature has designed the embryo by misexpressing these different Hox genes.
Yeah, and I want to come back to fruit flies in a second, but I was sort of thinking when you were talking that when you said from the early stages of sort of when we think about evolutionary history and the family tree of all multicellular organisms, that these genes are sort of tightly, I always think of the word conserved, right? Like,
yep.
They're just, they stay kind of the same because they work. And if you mess with them, you can, you know, get wings where they don't belong, or maybe an ear somewhere else that it shouldn't be. Coming back to fruit flies, though, I think, you know, many people might consider fruit flies a nuisance. it's the thing
that
eats crops or, you know, but as biologists, we also have something that we call model organisms that are model systems. And that's partly because of their utility in helping us unpack some pretty complicated questions. Why has the fruit fly been such a helpful animal in answering certain kinds of questions, especially developmental questions?
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, for one thing, we can use model organisms because of exactly what you said. There's so much conservation. The way in which different animals develop is really quite similar at a molecular level. Even though we look obviously very, very different from fruit flies and function very differently, the way that the body is put together, it's maybe a little hard to believe, but it's really quite, quite similar at a molecular level. And what evolution has done is taken that basic blueprint from the fruit fly and just expanded it, tinkered with it, so that you can get these different shapes of all of the different animals that we see around the earth. So the fruit fly kind of came into use by biologists sort of through serendipity. It was right around the turn of the 20th century, right around 1900, when people were mostly doing their work, as you mentioned, with frogs and sea urchins and that sort of thing. But there were biologists who were starting to think about genes. And you may be familiar with Gregor Mendel, often called the father of genetics, who, you know, did all of these studies on pea plants and sort of defined how genes work in plants. But people were skeptical. His work actually didn't really come to light originally. It was sort of ignored for around 30 years. And then people rediscovered Mendel's work around the turn of the century, and other people were able to reproduce his findings that there are all of these factors that control the traits of different plants. And some of these plant biologists even said that they could see in real time the emergence of new species. So new plants with different properties that they felt must be due to some abnormality in the gene. And so that was all well and good for the plant world, but people who were working on animals were looking at Mendel's work and looking at the work of these plant biologists and saying animals can't possibly work that way. They're way too complicated to think about something that, you know, causes a pea plant to have purple flowers or white flowers to have anything to do with how an animal develops. But this one researcher, a guy named Thomas Hunt Morgan, said, I'm going to see if I can find an animal that develops a new trait in the laboratory. And to be able to do that experiment, he needed an animal that could have a pretty rapid life cycle. Because if he took an animal that takes, you know, months to develop and then years to, you know, have its reproductive health, he, you know, he wouldn't ever have any chance of discovering a new type of animal, or a new mutant is what they became called. So he serendipitously turned to the fruit fly because it develops very rapidly. You can house them easily in a laboratory. And he fed the fruit flies a chemical that, he hoped would, allow them to develop these new traits. And after many, many months of looking, he finally found an animal that looked different. It was an animal, a fruit fly, that instead of the normal red eyes, had white eyes. And this was sort of the first animal mutation that was ever discovered.
Yeah, that's great. And for sharing all of those steps, what I love about science, and I don't know if you share that love, is, you know, the curiosity that can drive some of these questions and lead to interesting ways to solving some of these mysteries. I'm curious if white-eyed fruit fly could still see.
That's a great question. I don't know the answer.
I don't either. I'm going to find out, and I'll post it in the show notes.
All right, great. I bet they can, but I don't actually know for sure.
Okay, because I know fruit flies have what we call, I think, compound eyes, where is a compound eye just many different eyes in one eye?
I believe so. I believe so. And then the little fruit fly brain takes the many, many different pictures that come from each of those many eyes and puts it together.
That's right. Okay. So, and we know that how other animals see the world may not have anything to do with how we see the world. A great metaphor there for, you know, there is no real reality except through your own perception. But that's, you know, a different topic. Okay. So I think it's rather miraculous. and I don't know if other people feel this way, you know, listening, that from a single cell, we get, you know, a fully formed hippopotamus or a fully formed human with cells that continue carrying out their complex little lives as part of a larger unit that keeps us moving. And I don't think people realize how much has to go just right all the time. And you mentioned different cells and their jobs, whether it's during development or even later, right? Like if you are a liver cell and your job is, and maybe there's different types of liver cells, I'm sure there is, and they have their job and they got to talk to other liver cells, but they also got to talk to all kinds of other cells. So how do cells get their jobs? Do they apply or are they born with a job?
Once again, nature, nurture. The answer is yes. So they, I guess maybe the best metaphor for this is to think about human professions. How do we get our jobs? So in principle, anybody can become anything, right? You start off as a kid in grammar school and things happen. You get exposed to certain subjects and you find this is my passion. I want to be, a biologist and ecologist in Africa, or I want to be a lawyer or a school teacher or what have you. So all of those are possibilities. And as we go along, there are inclinations. We sort of get a hook into some subject or a series of subjects. And little by little, those hooks get more and more fixed so that ultimately this is what we become. We become an entrepreneur. We become, a university dean or something like that. The same kind of thing is happening during development. At that very early stage, one cell, two cell, et cetera, pretty much any cell can become anything. So I gave the example earlier of when you have 16 or 32 cells, some are on the inside and some are on the outside. And that difference will cause the inner cells to become something different than the outer cells. But that isn't written in stone. That's an inclination. If you took one of those inner cells and plucked it out and put it on the outside, it would change. It would now do what one of those outer cells would have normally done. So during development, cells get these inclinations. They start to move in one direction, and that gets reinforced over time as they receive signals from their neighbors that basically create a tissue. But if something should happen, if those signals get interrupted, if the cell moves into a different position, that signaling environment, the place where the cell finds itself, will be quite different and it will turn into something else.
Okay. So now I have a metaphor that occurred to me when you were talking about, depending on where you're located, that gives rise to a certain set of possibilities. And if you move, and I don't know how you would go from the inside to the outside, that's a separate issue, but then the possibilities change. So depending on your location or an other factor, there might be constraints on the possibilities. And I immediately thought, well, I wanted to be, so when I was a kid, what did I dream of being? And that was an NFL football player, followed by dancer, followed by actress. None of on the list was scientist. but those various hooks started coming in later and propelling me in a particular trajectory. And I was constrained on football because at that time, they did not allow females to play junior league or whatever, little league football. So I got funneled into soccer. So I could still become an athlete, just not that particular game. And of course, I'm kind of glad now that I did not become a football player, given, the physical trauma that they go through. But once let's say I'm a liver cell, I can't switch careers, right? I just am a liver cell.
Well, you know what? You can.
Ooh, tell me how.
You can. So to kind of go back to the metaphor a little bit. So, people tend to get a little set in their ways as they get older, and cells do too. So, you start off and you're a cell that has the possibility to become one of the internal organs like the liver or the pancreas or the stomach. And then little by little, you get pushed more and more to become a liver cell. So, and then you're an adult. And you're there in the liver, you're an adult liver cell. That's your job. But things happen, as we say. And the liver, like any tissue, can be subject to injury, an infection, a toxin, you drink too much. All of these kinds of things can cause inflammation in the liver, as they can cause inflammation in any tissue. And so how is the liver supposed to deal with that? Well, some cells will die, but as part of the response to injury, some cells will change their identity. And this is known in medical terms as metaplasia, where we see some types of cells that have a very particular job now taking on another job or looking very different as part of this response to the injury or to some kind of stimulus that the body is exposed to. So you can actually go back and explore some of those dreams, Jennifer.
Ooh, okay, I don't know which one to choose from. You bring up a really, you know, interesting point, which is that some cells die and some are responding by changing what they do and how they look. Does that mean that cells have their own intelligence, or are they just part of a collective that's taking directions from, let's say, a higher source in the body, if you will?
Yeah, that's, you know, you're getting into philosophy here. But no, I really think that everything that is happening that we're talking about here is happening at a chemical level. So again, imagine the condition of an injury to the liver. And so then the immune system is going to be called into action. And those immune cells are releasing all kinds of factors, all kinds of proteins. And those proteins are going to attach themselves to the liver cells. And the liver cells are then going to have a series of chemical reactions in response to those immune signals. And that's going to result in them acting in a particular way to try to cope with that injury. So everything is essentially, as I view it, a chain of events, molecular events, set into motion by things in the environment, like a virus, like an exposure.
Yeah. Well, and you also talk about cell societies. And so, you know, when we think about all the things that have to go right, things don't often go perfectly in this chemical communication space, whether it's early or later in an individual, and by individual now, I mean, you know, organism story. These cells or even cell societies can misbehave, go rogue, miscommunicate. What are some of the things that can go wrong at different times that aren't due to, let's say, a genetic defect, but are due to an environmental, you know, disturbance or just the normal day-to-day living of an organism?
Well, so, I mean, there are a couple of things that we could talk about. One is cancer. That certainly is, you know, something that can go wrong. The other is degenerative diseases of the body. Things just stop working through wear and tear. You know, our bodies are still mechanical devices. And just like anything, a dishwasher or a car, you know, they are going to be exposed to just wear and tear over time. And some tissues do a very good job of dealing with that. In fact, you know, our bodies outlive our cars and our dishwashers for the most part. And some animals, as you well know, exceed our lifespan by twofold or threefold or more. So nature's done a remarkable job of building machines that are quite durable, but eventually they fail. And that's the cause of many of the diseases that we face in the medical world, degenerative neurological diseases, for example, organ failure, heart disease, et cetera.
Yeah. And I think not all things, but some of those things are also a consequence of the inputs into the body in whatever form, which brings me back around to what you said in the beginning about, you know, kind of what motivated you, some of the work that was going on at the time and how it influenced your path. Let's talk about stem cells. I feel like there's a ton of controversy and misunderstanding around stem cells. And your book, From One Cell, does a great job, you know, discussing these cells and talking about them in a variety of different ways. What, just sort of for the basic audience, you know, what are stem cells? And then why are they so important when you're thinking about development or medicine?
So I'll do my best. So we can divide stem cells into two groups, adult stem cells and embryonic stem cells. And what a stem cell is basically it's kind of nature's solution to that one cell problem that I was talking about earlier, right? The problem being, how do you make more cells, but create a diverse set of cells that have these many, many different jobs? So what a stem cell is and how it's defined is it is a cell, a single cell, that has the capability when it divides to give rise to a different kind of cell and another stem cell, one of itself. So it's I include in the book the example of, imagine you find a genie in a bottle, and right, the thing you always would like to do when you release the genie and you're granted three wishes is wish for another wish. Yes. Right. So that's what a stem cell basically is you get, you know, you get a wish for something, but then one of your wishes is another wish. And so stem cells can make more stem cells indefinitely, but they also have the capacity to give rise to other types of cells. If we look at adult stem cells live in particular tissues. And so the types of cells that they can give rise to when they divide are limited to that tissue. An example of this would be the blood stem cells, or what's called the hematopoietic stem cells. So a hematopoietic stem cell or blood stem cell can give rise to any of the different kinds of cells that exist in the blood, the red blood cells that carry oxygen, the white blood cells that are immune cells that fight infection, and so on and so forth. But in general, they can't give rise to any other types of cells. They're really useful nevertheless. So when in the clinical world, a bone marrow transplant is done, what we're actually transplanting is those hematopoietic stem cells. We're taking an individual's existing blood system, depleting the stem cells from that person for reasons usually because of cancer, and then introducing stem cells from another individual into that patient. Embryonic stem cells have that same property of either giving rise to more stem cells or other types of cells. But in the case of an embryonic stem cell, the opportunities are almost limitless. The types of cells that an embryonic stem cell could be, in principle, anything: a neuron, a liver cell, a heart cell, and so on and so forth. So, of course, the excitement is if we have these cells, we could potentially use them to create any tissue to replace those that are lost from the kinds of diseases we were just talking about. Someone who has heart failure and their cardiomyocytes, the heart muscle cells, are no longer working. Well, maybe stem cells can give rise to new ones, and those can be used for transplantation. So that's you know, in a broad overview, what stem cells are and why we're so excited about them.
Okay. All right. Now I have a few follow-up questions, some of which could be, you know, they're not well-informed. It's just my curiosity piqued as I listen to you. So I'm going to go back to the liver. I don't know why I'm focused on the liver today, but it's my understanding that if you cut a piece of the liver off, maybe depending on how much of the liver you cut off, it'll regrow. Sort of like a lizard tail. You know, a lizard's tail will also regrow, but only if you don't cut off too much of it. And then it's just kind of stuck with a stumpy little tail. So does that mean that something like the liver, which can regenerate itself, has stem cells that are like embryonic or that they're, are they adult stem cells that just have a mission like regrow? And why can't that happen? Why can't you take then stem cells from the liver and just grow another liver if in the body it can grow?
You have just jumped into a huge controversial area.
Uh-oh.
So, and complicated area. So let me step back and distinguish what you were talking about with the lizard, amphibians regrowing a tail, and mammals and people. So there are many organisms that have this remarkable ability to regrow whole parts of the body, a limb, a tail, et cetera. Amphibians are really famous for this. A lot of crustaceans can do this as well. It's really amazing. For the most part, that is an attribute that has been lost during evolution. So we can't do that. It's actually, the term for it is epimorphic regeneration. Thomas Hunt Morgan, the guy, the fly guy with the first mutation, he described this way back a century ago. But we cannot regenerate whole body parts. And we could go into all of the reasons why we think that that's the case and why we've lost that ability. When the liver, so you're absolutely right about the liver. You can cut out a big chunk of the liver and it regrows back to its normal size. It's kind of like the myth of Prometheus, where, you know, he's accused of stealing fire and giving it to people. So a bird came and ate his liver every night and then it regrew the next day for eternity. So the liver can do this. It has this remarkable property, but we don't think that it's able to do that from stem cells. So it is the most regenerative organ, perhaps one of the most regenerative organs in the body. But the way that the liver regenerates itself is actually just the simple replication of the existing cells. So you have cells in the liver called hepatocytes. You remove half of the liver, the remaining hepatocytes divide once or twice, and you regrow your liver. So it's not clear that there are stem cells in the liver. Not all organs have stem cells.
Okay, that's really important to know, because I was just going to, you know, ask, you know, obviously there's differences between your run-of-the-mill adult stem cells and your embryonic stem cells that you mentioned in terms of what you can become. You're still at that stage. You can choose anything to become as an embryonic stem cell. And as an adult stem cell, you are what you are, and you can maybe become another one of what you are. Right?
You got it. Yep.
Okay. And now we've just established that our liver does not regenerate, probably by the same mechanism as we see regeneration in other organisms of different body parts. So that would be why we can't just like take a piece of liver and grow a liver and put it back inside a person, right?
Well, I mean, you may be asking, another way of asking the question is okay, if those remaining liver cells are so good at dividing, right? You can get a new liver from half a liver just from simple division. Why is there such a thing as liver failure in the first place? And why can't we transplant those liver cells with all of that great capacity from one person to another? Why do we have to transplant the whole liver instead of taking out the cells with this ability to replicate? Is that a fair way of asking the question?
And why not, when I'm like 18 and healthy, can't we just take a little piece of my liver, grow it and save it so that if I end up in trouble later, before everything went sideways, whether from the environment or me drinking too much, which is not a problem, but just, you know, in case, right? Could we just not then have a reserve liver that we can then put back in our own body?
And just take that little piece and put it back in and let it grow to a full liver. So the reason that that is not so easy, maybe it'll be possible one day, but not so easy right now, is another aspect of that one cell problem, that way that we build organs from the very beginning, which is not only is it, do you need more cells and the right kinds of cells, but they need to be in the right place relative to all these other cells. So when you take a piece of the liver out and the rest of the liver regrows, the shape and the spatial orientation of all the cells in the liver are already there. They're already in the right place. They just need to expand. But if you want to transplant cells, and this is an issue with all stem cell or any cell-based therapy, the cells have to get in the right position to be able to function. And that's something that the embryo can do because of all of this crosstalk and decision-making during embryogenesis, but it's not something that we can do as physicians or tissue engineers yet.
Okay. That's really, wow, that's so interesting. Now I have another. Now we're going to go back to embryos and embryonic stem cells, because that's also where a lot of the controversy is, but it's also where a lot of the potential is for solving some problems. And you know, as we've already learned in our conversation, or as I've learned, you already knew this, but as I've learned, an embryo is a collection of cells. And when it becomes this mini-me looking thing, that's already now a fetus. So when we're thinking about embryonic, an embryo, it's the cluster of cells that is beginning to subdivide into their various jobs and lay out the body plan. Now, I taught a genetics course once back in 2016. And I remember reading about a discovery that a mom, a human mom, had cells in her body that had Y chromosomes. And this led to the term microchimera. And just for, you know, a chimera, right, is like if you piece together two different things to create a new thing. Is that a basic enough description of a chimera?
Yeah, different types of cells within the same body. Yeah.
Okay. So this led to this term microchimera, and then further investigation sort of led to the discovery that the location of these cells was not random. And what they essentially concluded was that developing embryos have these cells that escape the uterus, presumably through the placenta, since it's a two-way street, essentially. And they go to certain places in the mom's body. And there might be some good reasons for where they go. But then I'm curious, because a lot of people talk about saving placenta and all of this stuff. Is there anything useful in terms of the presence of embryonic stem cells inside the placenta that would not require the use of embryos, but could be harvested from there? And would that address the controversy? I know that's a multi-layered question. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. Microchimerism is a really interesting topic. There are stem cells, blood stem cells in the placenta, in the umbilical vein in particular. And so that is actually an active area of practice, is banking of those cells from newborn babies. And so you were, you know, imagining taking a piece of liver and putting it in the freezer. So this is happening with umbilical vein stem cells from newborns all over the place. And they're banked, they're put in freezers if, you know, for some reason someday that baby will need a hematopoietic blood stem cell transplant. So that's one form of stem cells, although even though it's from a baby, you would still kind of call them adult stem cells because they have this more limited tissue capacity. A lot of the controversy, of course, about embryonic stem cells comes from the fact that they're generated very early in embryogenesis, and there's no real way to extract an embryonic stem cell from an embryo without destroying the embryo. And so that's, of course, the reason why so many people have objected to the research. What happened in the early 2000s was that a Japanese scientist figured out a way to make cells that behave exactly like embryonic stem cells. So they can turn into any cell in the body, they can make more of themselves, but without touching an embryo. And so any adult cell, in principle, you can introduce these genes. There are a set of genes that when you introduce them into a skin cell, it could be a cell from the cheek, it could be really any cell in the body, that cell gets converted into something that looks and behaves like an embryonic stem cell. So much of the field has really moved away from embryonic stem cells into these other type of embryonic stem-like cells called induced pluripotent cells or iPS cells.
Do you see that field advancing to where we can solve the problem of creating a liver or creating a heart? Or, you know, I mean, a lot of people are just obsessed with looking youthful. And you always see advertisements, you know, apply stem cells and you'll look younger. is there actually any way to keep ourselves younger? And is the field moving in a direction of solving some of these medical problems, which are more serious?
Yeah. So the answer is probably yes, with time. I will just sort of point out that even though we've been working with stem cells for quite some time, we really don't have any therapies, or very few, really next to no therapies yet that benefit from stem cells. So most of the advertisements that are seen for cosmetic uses of stem cells and so on and so forth are unproven. They're not evidence-based, and just your listeners should be very skeptical of those, which are, you know, very often money-making. But there are a few real glimmers of hope and progress. And the areas where stem cells are being coaxed to turn into different types of clinically useful cells, the leading edge is when the cells don't need that correct spatial orientation. When you just need the cells to be somewhere, and as long as they're in the right place, they'll do their function. You don't need a proper three-dimensional structure. So one of the leading examples of this is the treatment of type 1 diabetes with stem cells. So type 1 diabetes is caused because certain cells in the pancreas are destroyed by the immune system. So these are cells called the islets of Langerhans. They make insulin. The body has decided, for whatever reason, that this is a foreign invader, these cells, and destroys them. So you end up with no islet cells and no insulin, and have very severe type of diabetes. So for many years, people have thought, stem cells would be the perfect way to approach this problem, because if we can turn stem cells into islet cells, we already know that islet cells can go other places in the body and survive and produce insulin and be able to treat the diabetes, just as we give insulin injections to a diabetic. So over the last couple of years, there's been some really impressive advances in this front of being able to take embryonic stem cells, turn them into these insulin-producing cells, give them to patients, and in some cases, those patients appear to be cured of their diabetes. So really remarkable progress is afoot.
Yes, no, it's exciting. And, you know, we didn't even have a chance to talk about cloning, but I encourage readers, you know, of your book, From One Cell, A Journey of Into Life's Origins and the Future of Medicine, to enjoy that part. And I know you're busy, so I'm just going to wrap this up with probably two questions. So I really enjoyed the way in your book, From One Cell, you detailed how past and present scientists embark kind of on an odyssey, you know, if you will, searching for answers and applying various techniques, overcoming obstacles, designing new approaches, all to solve a puzzle. you shared the passion and the pursuits and drive of a scientist named John Gurdon, and I'll let the readers, you know, discover that story. But what is a puzzle that you're currently hunting to solve?
Wow, what a great question. So a lot of things going on in the laboratory. As I mentioned at the beginning, the book is about development, but my lab is focused on cancer biology right now. And in particular, pancreatic cancer is what we're working very hard to try to understand better and come up with better treatments. And so a lot of what we do in the laboratory looking at cancer is derived from understanding embryogenesis, because even though on first principles, you'd think cancer and embryos have virtually nothing to do with each other, they're actually very, very similar. They both grow rapidly. They both involve lots of signaling and so on and so forth. So a big part of what we're trying to understand is how the different cell types that make up a tumor, which includes cancer cells, but also non-cancer cells, just like the many cells that make up the embryo, how do they talk to each other? And is that communication, that cell-cell communication, a target for new cancer therapies?
Wow. Well, and so that leads me to the last question. And thank you, by the way, for the important work you're doing. I know several people who have lost family members rapidly to aggressive pancreatic cancer. And the survival rates are not very good for people diagnosed. So what you're doing is really important work. And I think, though, that also many people think of scientists, you know, this is why I love to have people like you on the show. You know, there is this connection. We all, whether we're a giraffe or a lion or a gorilla or a human or a cat or your dog, started from one cell and go on this journey. And many of the things that you're talking about impact. You know, my cat had had cancer. Two of my cats had cancer, right? So all of these things affect all living multicellular organisms in various ways. But the reason I love having people like you on, not only because you've written this incredibly rich book, but because I think a lot of people think of scientists as remote, rigid individuals that aren't people too. And they don't realize how much creativity is infused in the process of science. They just think like we're robots. We read a book, we learned a process, you know, the scientific process, and that's what we do. But as your book so, you know, beautifully describes all of these different discoveries that have led us to where we are today and where we might go in the future, there was a lot of out of the box thinking. And so I'm curious, you know, when was there a time or when was there a moment in what you were doing when out of the box thinking led you to realize a particular piece of a puzzle?
Yeah, I mean, it happens all the time. And you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I think we don't do science education as well as we could in this country. People are fed facts, but that's really not what science is. It's an inquiry. If you like crossword puzzles or any kind of puzzles, you're a scientist, you know, and kids are scientists, right? Before they get that curiosity beaten out of them all too often in secondary school and beyond. The other thing about science, before I answer your question, is it's actually very social, right? That's another thing that I think people may not understand. They think of the lone, you know, scientists working and, you know, trying to solve their problem and maybe socially awkward, which sometimes is true, but often not. So I'll give you an example from my own work in development when I was trying to understand size regulation. How do our bodies, why are we the size we are and we're not as big as elephants? And why is the left side of the body the same length as the right side of the body, our arms and whatever, and trying to, you know, think about that problem. Well, I wasn't really thinking about that problem. I was actually thinking about another problem, and my control experiment wasn't working. I was making mouse embryos and manipulating mouse embryos and trying to introduce other kinds of cells, and I got these embryos that were different sizes or parts of the body were different sizes. I was like, I went to my friends, the other postdocs in the lab, and I said, this experiment isn't working. My control isn't working. What am I doing wrong? And they, in very nice words, kind of said I was an idiot for not recognizing that the control result was telling me something really important about how the size of an organ is determined. The fact that the control wasn't working was itself an experimental result. And I kind of thought about that and went on from there to actually, you know, discover something about size regulation.
That's awesome. And I think sometimes, you know, like my dissertation, you know, all of it was negative results, the whole thing. And we're so attached to sometimes certain outcomes. And that's just a human condition. It's not particular to scientists. It's why, you know, there's even road rage. We assumed we were going to get to our destination in a certain amount of time. And we are blinded to what we see going on around us. But your book illuminates a lot of things for people. I want to thank you, Ben, for being on the show. I encourage everyone to get a copy of From One Cell. It's coming out in
August 8th.
And where can people keep up with you and follow your work or Twitter, you know, or social media?
Yeah. So I, my Twitter handle is BenStanger01. And I'm at the University of Pennsylvania. I have a webpage there, and And it's been great talking with you. This has been a ton of fun.
Thank you.
Oof, what a great conversation, and one that I couldn't have timed better given what we're seeing come out of Alabama last week. Now, I did promise to find out if white-eyed fruit flies could see, and in fact, they can see. And I even include a link to a cool experiment out of Duke University in the show notes that was done with students. Now, you might remember that we had Dr. Muhammad Noor on the last episode, and he is one of the authors. As we wrap up this episode and discussion with Dr. Stanger, I really urge you to share this podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues who are curious about embryos, now that it's in the news, embryonic development, the promise of stem cells, and their profound impact on human health. All of this matters, and it matters to people like you or your friends, especially right now, because there's a lot of misinformation that's been put out there. For the Alabama Supreme Court to equate embryos as children only underscores the lingering misunderstanding, misinformation of a time of preformationist ideologies that go back to the 19th century and earlier. We know so much more today than we did then. And mistaking development as a process of unfolding predetermined forms, which is the only thing that could make embryos children, rather than seeing it as the dynamic interplay of molecular signals that are interfacing with environmental cues, perpetuates these misunderstandings that echo not just through the corridors of time, but apparently through the corridors of justice. And as we can see, this lack of basic understanding of how we go from a single cell to the marvelous, fully formed creatures we and other species are impacts our lives in a very personal way. Embryos are not children. Full stop. By spreading knowledge and fostering conversations, we can empower individuals to make more informed decisions and support the incredible and much needed advancements in medical science. So let's start talking. Let's talk embryonic stem cells that have the potential to become anything, because each of us has the potential to become scientists, to become informed, and to share what we know with others and have these conversations. So let's put on our thinking caps, folks. It matters. Thanks so much for being part of our community at Wild Connection. Thanks for listening, and until next time.